Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, sponsored by WebSpy. It's November 10, 2009, and this is episode 216. What a crazy week it's been. I've had so much trouble with my server and the websites this week, it's just not funny. I apologise if you came by and things were down. I actually have a few things that I need to ask you to check. So please stay tuned for the housekeeping section at the end of this episode. This is the start of a two-part series where we go back to basics. Following the recent revival of a five-year-old post in which I tried to give advice for the beginner photographer getting started, I decided to have a go at giving this same advice from a Martin Bailey version 2009 perspective. Before we go on to the main topic, I'd like to say a big thanks to our sponsors, WebSpy, the Internet Monitoring, Analysis and Reporting Specialists. And as usual, I'd like to ask you to tweet the message, thanks to @WebSpy for sponsoring the @MartinBailey Photography Podcast on Twitter to show your support. To find out more about WebSpy and their products, go to webspy.com/MBP and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on anything that you buy. Okay, so last week a new user on the forums, Chua Kim Yu, username Red Panda Fire from Montreal, Canada, revived an old thread from June 2004. I'd posted an article called Fundamental Advice for Photographers Getting Started, and I had to admit that looking back at this forum post from over 5 years ago, there were a lot of things that I thought that I would have written differently now. The article itself is a little presumptuous, and I would have worded it much differently for a start. But as a photographer, have also changed a lot over the last 5 years, I decided to sit down and think about how I would write something like this today. And that's what the topic of today's episode is going to be. And it, as I said, this is the first of a two-part series. Once I actually got into writing this, I quickly got to like 10 pages of A4, so I figured that I'd split it into two podcasts. There's a link to the original article in the show notes in case you're interested, but I'm going to start afresh today and just go through what I would probably tell a beginner today. I should say that this is not an article on how to get started as a professional photographer and set up a business, etc. It's really targeted for the total beginner that's just bought a camera and maybe just sort of made the jump from a compact digital to a digital SLR and wants really a kickstart to get them up to speed on the fundamentals. I should also say that it's of course not comprehensive. To cover everything that you need to know about photography would require multiple very fat books, not a single podcast episode. This should be a good primer though, so here we go with my Photography Fundamentals for the Beginner, version 2009. So you've stumbled across photography and started to make pictures with either a high-end compact digital or a digital single-lens reflex camera or a DSLR. Photography is great fun, and to really put yourself in a position to get started quickly and learn the craft well, I suggest you take the following points, the things that we talk about over the next today and next week, into consideration as you experiment with your new camera. Firstly, realize that although some people can become good photographers from any one side or the other, in general, to be a good photographer, you'll need to be able to work at being both an artist and a technician, quite often at the same time. People will tell you that it's not about the gear, and that's true to an extent, but don't interpret this to mean that you don't need to learn how to use your gear or learn the fundamental techniques and rules and theories. Some of the technical stuff won't make sense at first, and that's okay. But the sooner you plant these seeds, the easier it will be for them to fall into place later. So, some people joke about never reading their manual. Some people boast about this, thinking that they're so cool or intelligent that they don't need to. Both of these activities won't help you to learn how to use your camera to its fullest potential. No matter how many times I upgrade my camera bodies, the first thing I do is to to sit down for an evening and read the manual with my new camera at my side. When upgrading, there are some paragraphs and chapters that are pretty much straight copy and paste from the previous manual. In this case, skip over it quickly, but don't ignore it totally. As this guide is for, total beginners though, I assume that this is your first camera, so do read the entire manual for your camera and for any lenses that you've picked up as well, or any other gear that you've grabbed. If you have a DSLR, it's really important that you learn how to use all of the functions on there. When you are done reading the manual, you'll have a good knowledge of what the various settings are for and how to change them. So the next most important thing is have fun. If you're already getting out, experimenting and having fun, then that's great. But if not, by all means, continue to read and listen to the rest of this. But take your time and don't get too bogged down in the details. There's a huge amount of information out there. Just looking through our photography forum and the blog, my blog and the podcast that I've done over the last 4.5 almost years, it will certainly help. But of course, that's just my community and, the stuff that I've directly put out there. The internet is literally teeming with information on photography these days, so much so that it's very easy to concentrate so much on studying about it all and trying to learn every detail that you forget to just get out there and shoot. Ideally, you'll be able to strike a balance where you study some of the time, maybe in the evenings, and then you'll get out and shoot and experiment to your heart's content as well. So next, we're going to get into exposure basics. There are three elements that will influence your camera's exposure, and these are the aperture, the shutter speed, and the ISO. In the film days, ISO was set by the film that you bought, and so once you had a roll of film in the camera, you were pretty much stuck at that ISO until you changed the roll. But now with cameras, with digital cameras, you can change it freely by shot if you want to. And so it really can be counted as a per-frame exposure setting. Aperture. This is the hole inside the lens that controls how much light gets through during the exposure. Apertures are somewhat confusingly rated by small numbers for wide apertures and large numbers for small apertures. So f2.8 is pretty wide, whereas f32 is pretty small. The aperture size is represented by an F number and often referred to as an f-stop. Common F numbers or full F stops are F1.4, very wide, small number, very wide, F2, F2.8, F4, 5.6, 8, 11, F16, F22, and F32. With each of these F number increments, the amount of light that enters the camera to make the image is reduced by half. The weird numbering for F numbers actually comes from the fact that they're a ratio of the focal length and the aperture. For example, if you have a 100mm lens with a widest aperture of f2.8, the widest aperture is actually going to measure about 36mm across. If we divide 100 by 4, the next full f-stop down from f2.8, then we get 25mm, a 25mm aperture, which is half the area. Let's not get too hung up on these calculations for now, though. Just note that the larger the number, the smaller the aperture, and the less light gets into the camera. Next is shutter speed. This tells the camera how long you want it to allow light into the camera. The longer the shutter speed, the more light enters the camera and the brighter your resulting photograph will become. Also, as the world around us is moving, the length of your shutter speed can drastically change how your image looks. If you photograph a lake with a fast shutter speed at, say, 1/250th of a second, you will freeze any movement, any waves on the water, and you'll be able to see all of the waves on the surface of the lake pretty much as you would perceive it if you just looked at it with the naked eye. If, however, you do a very long exposure, like in my example image that I'll put in the blog and in the enhanced podcast, this is number 2320, by the way, all of the movement blurs into a smooth, flat surface on the lake. And so, you know, we can't actually see this. It's something that we can't see with the naked eye. You're making this effect with a long shutter speed. Shutter speeds are also counted in stops by halving or doubling the amount of time. One stop faster than 1/250th of a second is 1/500th of a second. And one stop slower is 1/125th of a second, and so on. Next up is ISO. The ISO rating is the sensitivity of the film or digital sensor to light. Standard ISO or 100, ISO 100 or 200 is, you know, it's pretty much what we consider standard. There's a term called native ISO, which is the best ISO that a camera will work at, but we're not going to get into that today. It used to be that ISO 100 to 400 was like the safe range. You know, years ago we were talking even 100, 50, 25 and 50 were like pretty standard, but you know, from about 20 years or so ago, 100 to 400 was a good safe range. Before you started to get too much sort of noise or grain in your image. But cameras these days, you know, I mean, that was true of digital cameras as well until a few years ago. But cameras these days are happily shooting very clean images at much higher ISOs. So experiment with your camera. Depending on the model that you've got, you'll get grain earlier. But experiment with the ISOs to see what you can shoot at and use the entire range as necessary. It, you know, a lot of the time it's better to have a grainy shot than no shot at all through it, you know, too slow a shutter speed and everything's blurred. As with the aperture and shutter speed, ISO is also counted in stops and doubles and halves as you increase or decrease the ISO. Note too that most cameras these days allow you to select apertures, shutter speeds and ISO ratings in 1/3 increments. So as you change these values, you'll have you know, two other numbers between the full values that we looked at here. Any of the above values will change exposure. You can also raise one and lower the other to achieve the same exposure. For example, say we start off with the camera set to ISO 100 with an aperture of f5.6 and the shutter speed set to 1/125th of a second. If you change your aperture from f5.6 to f8, you'll reduce the amount of light getting into your camera and therefore reduce the exposure by one stop. To make up for that with the other settings, you could increase the ISO from 100 to 200, or you could increase the shutter speed, you know, make the shutter speed slower, say by changing it from 1/125th of a second to 1/60th of a second. Likewise, if you want to have a faster shutter speed to freeze some action, you could increase it by, say, two stops from 1/125th of a second to 1/500th of a second, and then change, say, the ISO and the aperture accordingly. You could change both by one stop, moving the ISO to 200 and the aperture to f4, or you could change, say, just the aperture, go down to f2.8, moving it by two stops and leave the ISO where it is, assuming that your lens goes that wide, of course. This is a little bit complicated, but hopefully will be, you know, making some sense. Don't worry if it's not making sense. We, you know, we really just want to be, like I said, sowing seeds here, and it will all fall into place at some point, I assure you. Next, let's talk about depth of field. Depth of field is the area of an image that's in focus. Let's look at example image 2289, where we can see the second statue from the right is in sharp focus, but the one to the right in the foreground and the other statues in the background are all blurred. This is because the second statue from the right is inside the depth of field and the others aren't. This image was shot with a wide aperture of f2.8 and a long focal length of 175mm using my 70-200mm f2.8 lens. The depth of field is directly affected by the aperture, the distance to the subject, and the focal length of the lens. We discussed the way a smaller aperture lets in less light, but also, as we make the aperture smaller, we increase the depth of field, make it deeper. If we move further away from the object or focus on something deep in the scene, we also increase the depth of field, even without changing the aperture. The closer the subject gets, the shallower the depth of field becomes, and this is why close-up or macro photography requires very small apertures to achieve enough depth of field to get even very small subjects, like the mushrooms in image number 2395, in focus. In fact, even with an aperture of f11, with a 100mm macro lens, the mushroom there, which was probably around 1cm in depth, is not all in focus. The front and back edges of the head of the mushroom are slightly out of the depth of field. Also, to illustrate how wide-angle lenses have deeper depth of field, let's look at image number 2283, which was shot with an ultra-wide-angle lens at 14mm. Here I used an aperture of f8, a wider aperture than the mushroom shot at f11, and yet everything from the tree that we're looking up into in the close foreground to the distant trees along the bottom of the frame is in focus. I personally like to shoot wide apertures and create lots of creamy bokeh, which is the out of focus areas of the image, whenever possible. As a general rule though, when I shoot landscapes, as with most people, I try to get the entire scene in sharp focus, so I work to get small apertures. And remember, this is a fine balance, because if you go too small, past f16 for example, the image actually starts to become less sharp, even though the depth of field increases. So you don't want to just shoot everything at f32, or your images won't be as sharp as you'd like. If I'm doing flower shots or portrait work, I generally try to get as little of the image in focus as possible, meaning, you know, a very, very shallow depth of field. And it takes experience to know how much depth of field any focal length, aperture, and focus distance combination will give you. But luckily, you know, there are tools to play with too to help you understand this. If you have an iPhone, search for one of the great depth of field tools like DOF Calc. And there's also a great tool that works on Windows called Barnek, that you can play with to see how the focal length and the distance to the subject and the aperture create varying depth of field. And I'll put links to these two applications in the show notes as well. Next, let's talk about getting out of the program mode. To control the aperture and depth of field, as you become more comfortable using your camera, try to move out of the P or program mode. The program mode allows for very little control over the aperture and the shutter speed. If you don't understand how to change the camera's shooting mode, again, look at your manual. Most of the time, you'll want to shoot in aperture priority mode or shutter priority modes. Aperture priority mode allows you to set the camera's aperture, and the camera will set the shutter speed accordingly by looking at the scene and evaluating with the camera's meter how much light you need to make an optimal exposure. If the scene is very dark, you'll have a long shutter speed. If the scene is very light, you'll have a shorter shutter speed. You'll use the aperture priority when you want to control the depth of field that we just spoke about. If you need to tell the camera how fast you want the shutter speed and don't care about the depth of field, then you could try the shutter priority instead. You might use this, for example, if you're going to be shooting sports or racing cars and you need to stay above a certain or at a certain shutter speed to ensure that you freeze the action. Many people find though that selecting the aperture in aperture priority mode and selecting a high enough ISO to maintain a fast shutter speed gives the most control. There's also manual mode in which you pretty much take full control of the camera, but that's a little bit more advanced and probably outside of the scope of this episode. The light meters and computers in our cameras today are incredibly intelligent. They have scenes in their memory that they compare with what you've framed, and they try to adjust the exposure accordingly. But at the end of the day, they're still machines and they make mistakes. To override this, your camera has a feature called exposure compensation. This is usually adjusted by the big dial on the back of your camera, but again, refer to your manual to make sure that you know where this is. You will need to use exposure compensation when the scene that you're photographing is extremely light or extremely dark. For example, to shoot an image like number 2183, which is basically a pale grey tree in a field of snow with a white sky, I would have used around plus 1 1/3 of a stop of additional exposure using the exposure compensation feature. This is because the camera tries to make everything look like an 18% grey or a mid-tone grey. To compensate for this and make the snow look white, I increase the exposure. If we think about a very dark scene as well, like say a brown bear in a dark cave, I would, from a great distance, probably have to decrease the exposure by around one stop so that the camera didn't make the scene too bright, which would of course ruin the mood of the shot. We want it all to look dark. Unfortunately, I don't yet have an example image to show you of that. The last thing to note before we move on from exposure is that, you know, these days with the digital revolution, we've now got the almighty histogram to rely on. So histograms, reading histograms is a little bit complicated, and I don't want to get into too much detail here, but basically a histogram maps the light. It's a graph that you can display on the back of your camera, and I do suggest that you set your camera so that this is viewed at least when you look at the preview of the image that you've just taken. Basically though, the histogram is a graph and it maps the darkest tones in your image to the lightest tones from left to right. And the more tones you have in the dark side, the higher the graph gets. The more tones you have on the light side, the higher the graph gets on the right side, and the closer to the right side it gets. Basically, what you want to look at here is that you don't have your histogram touching the right side or the right shoulder unless you know why it's there. Say you've got the sun in the shot and you're going to allow that to become overexposed slightly so that you don't have to make the rest of the shot too dark. Then, you know, you want to basically stop it from hitting the right side of the shoulder. You also want to turn on the flashing highlight warning if your camera supports that. And again, check the manual to see how you do this. But what that will do is it will show you on the, you'll have the histogram and you'll have the image that's shown on the LCD. And if there are areas that are blown out, then they'll be flashing. If you don't care about those areas, they're what we call specular highlights, then don't worry about it. But if you think that the area that's flashing should be in, within the range, the dynamic range of the image so that it's not overexposed, then you'll want to use your exposure compensation to reduce exposure slightly until that stops flashing and until the right side of the histogram stops hitting the right shoulder. The last thing that I wanted to talk about is RAW. I do suggest that you get used to using RAW from very early on. Most cameras come set to shoot images, to save images to your compact flash or your memory card in JPEG format from the start. Find out how to change that to RAW and change it. If you want to, you know, remain in JPEG while you're practicing and experimenting, then that's fine, I guess. But RAW is actually more forgiving if you get the exposure a little bit off. And, you know, the image quality is better. Because the camera basically doesn't have to compress the image. And, you know, what it does when it compresses the image down is it loses detail, especially in heavily textured areas. Using RAW does bring a little bit of an overhead in post-processing, but tools like Lightroom for Windows and Mac and Aperture for the Mac only make it so easy to work with RAW files that there really is no excuse. There's no reason not to use it, especially when hard disk space is also now so cheap. Do yourself a favor and get used to using RAW files from the start. Next week, we'll get into some fundamental composition techniques and a few other areas, so please do stay tuned if you're finding this useful. So that's it for this first part of this two-part episode, and I would like to thank Chua for reviving that old thread and prompting today's and next week's podcast. It's been fun to do this, and hopefully many others will find this useful. Also, I need to apologize, as I mentioned in the introduction, for all of the website and podcast problems over the last week. I'm really sorry if you had problems. It really has been an awful week. Firstly, the iPhone versions of the video podcast that I released last week had issues, and basically they wouldn't sync to some people's the first few wouldn't sync to anyone's iPhone. I tried multiple encoding tools, and I need to thank Forrest Tanaka, one of the moderators and a huge contributor to the MVP community, as Forrest pointed me to a tool that finally helped me to re-encode the video for iPhone without having to go to a MOV or a movie format that Apple convert the files to in iTunes. The file size doubled in the conversion, but it like quadruples if you convert in iTunes, so I'm happy enough. Anyway, if you are currently stuck with a copy of the video in iTunes that will not sync to your phone, please right click and delete that episode and select to remove it from your hard drive if asked. Then right-click the feed again and select Show All Available Episodes. And this will show the as a grayed out link, the original or the new file that's optimized for iPhone. And then you can just download that again and it will sync to your iPhone without problems. Also, the other big issue, I'm not talking about a magazine here. My provider decided last Friday, to finally do a hardware upgrade that I'd paid for in September, and the problem is that they didn't give me any notice and they didn't give me any time to test before it went live either, despite promising me that both of these things would happen. Because of that, since last Friday, all of the MVP sites, including the forum and the blog, the members gallery, have all been up and down like the proverbial drawers. As of today, November 10th, things do seem to have finally settled down. I do need to ask anyone that has already voted for the October assignment to go back and check your votes. If you voted since last Friday and over this last weekend until November 10th, then go to the Members Gallery's website and go into the October assignment gallery and click on the show voting status link above the voting buttons. And if your votes are lost, I'm really sorry about this, but please navigate to your selected images and vote again before November the 14th, 4 days from now. Finally, I'd like to remind you that the November assignment, supported by our sponsors WebSpy, is now in progress and the theme is panned. We're looking for a panned shot or a panning shot of a moving subject. The subject can be anything as long as it's moving and you're panning with it from a stationary position. Taking, you know, panned shots takes a little bit of practice, but you should have some fun. It's been so long that I'm almost embarrassed to suggest this, but you could also listen to episode 4 of this podcast in which I discuss some of the techniques that I use for panning shots. Thank you to WebSpy for supporting the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast and for providing some great prizes that will be given to the three winners with the most accumulated votes from the assignments from the last 6 months, including this month's. In December, those prizes will go out. Details of the prizes and the assignment guidelines are in the assignment and critique forum at martinbaileyphotography.com. And that does it for this week. Long one, but thanks for listening. And remember that you can find me on Twitter, Flickr, Facebook, as well as my blog and the photography forum. All links to these various places are on the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com. So swing by and check that out if you're interested. And I'll be back next week with another Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Until then, you just have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye. The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.